All right, our final speaker today in this session is Morgan Oscar Morell. He studied audio engineering and film and video production at the University of Michigan, go Wolverines. From there, he began working on media reformatting projects through U of M's Language Resource Center, eventually receiving his MLIS from U of M School of Information. He is also a bit of a record collector, where his interests are currently focused on privately pressed psychedelic music and Jamaican dancehall music. He is currently the IT systems administrator for George Blood Audio and Video in Philadelphia, where he develops automated systems and digital preservation workflows. Please welcome Morgan.
Thanks, Mark. I want to again extend everybody's gratitude. This is my first time at ARSC, so first time presenting as well. It's really nice to be so welcoming. And it's also really nice to put names to a lot of, or faces to a lot of names that I've seen. I contacted a lot of people through email, and it's nice to see friendly faces. All right, I'll talk a little louder as well. Okay, can everybody hear me now? All right, thanks. I just want to check one thing about this. There, that seems to be going well. All right. Oh no, I've lost it. All right. I have a little bit of a tech demo that I want to skip to, but it looks like it may make displays a bit strange, unfortunately. All right. So today I'm going to be talking about Columbia's Mets. So I work as the IT systems administrator for George Blood Audio, Video, Film, and two major parts of my responsibilities are to develop and maintain our automation systems, as well as manage our database. And our database is what stores, collects, and harvests all the information about transfer projects, as well as other institutional information, such as contact information, service tickets, information about our equipment inventory. And we use it all around, but with transfer projects, it's holding all the information about the objects we're processing, as well as the information about the files. So over the past 5 years, Columbia University Libraries has been working with George Blood to preserve recordings containing a variety of audio content. As part of the deliverables for this project, George Blood has been providing Columbia with metadata encoding and transmission standards. That's METS XML. So Columbia uses the METS XML as part of their ingest package for their digital asset management system. In this presentation, I'm going to explain how Columbia's METS works, as well as how we at George Blood create it. The goal is to provide you with an idea of what METS can do and what it looks like. Of course, the problem here is that METS is huge, and it varies greatly between institutions and projects. So with that in mind, remember that some of the nitty-gritty detail may not apply to you, but I'm hoping to give you an overview and let you know what is going to be different if you try to do it yourself. And I also want to make sure that you know that what you need to provide to your vendor and what you should expect from them, there can be a lot of efficiency increases you get by being transparent and communicative with your vendor about what you're sending them and what they're sending back. So you'll definitely want to sort these details out before you embark on a METS-driven initiative, whether or not you plan to use a vendor. So know what you want, know where to start, and also learn from our experience. Before I can talk about METS that we create, I'm going to have to talk about the context in which it's created. So I'm going to give you the who, what, and how. It's displayed here kind of at a higher level perspective. And this is important for two reasons. First, it's just going to give you a framework for what I'm talking about so that terms make sense. But also, this information is actually in the METS and useful in creating the METS. So it's kind of twofold there. So starting with the who, We are George Blood Audio Video Film. We're a vendor specializing in archival audio and moving image transfer services, and we've processed up to 10,000 hours of content in a month. So in this institution, the key players are Martha Horan. She's our registrar, and she handles all of the incoming and outgoing metadata, objects, and deliverables, and there she is in our vault. And this includes any original physical assessment of the objects as they come in. So then we have Tad Matsura. He handles the audio transfers with Columbia projects. So this includes any physical intervention that'll be done on the tape, such as cleaning or baking, before he runs the tape, as well as running the tape and running the automation systems that create the digital deliverables, including the audio files and the METS. And then there's me. It's a little pixelated. I don't know if you can tell. But I make sure all the automation and IT systems work. And when they don't work, I fix them. And when they really don't work, I have to build new ones. And when those don't work, I'm at the bar down the street. So then the next big major agent here is Columbia University Libraries. We've been working with them for over 5 years and have processed over 3,500 unique objects for them. Janet Gertz is our main point of contact. She's the director of the Preservation and Digital Conversion Division at Columbia. And I've also worked very closely with Terry Catapano. He's the digital librarian, and he works with me on the nitty-gritty details of the Mets, validating Mets when we make changes. And he knows what Columbia is doing with them when they receive them. Working with Columbia, we have this paradigm of the on-demand project where they'll send us a tape and we'll process it as quickly as possible and get it back to them. So sometimes objects will come in as large collections, but sometimes they'll just come in as single objects. So that's the who. And before I get into the what, I want to give you some vocab just so we're on the same page. An intellectual unit is defined as a discrete unit of content, and the boundaries are loose, and some institutions may choose one way to define an intellectual unit over another. For example, if you have a two-sided audio cassette tape, an intellectual unit may be that entire cassette tape, or it may be an individual side on the cassette tape, or it may be programs, mini programs on a side. So if you're going to do this sort of work, that's up to you to decide. Just make sure that it's the same every time. And then next is a deliverable set, and the set of digital deliverables that's basically the set of digital deliverables related to a single intellectual unit, and that's how we process the files. So all of the digital deliverables for an intellectual unit are in a single folder, and then they kind of nest out from there, but we call that a deliverable set, that folder, as well as the record that represents that folder. So the project we're talking about in 2008, Columbia started the Mellon Audio Preservation Project, and the guidelines for this project were laid out. They laid out how audio objects would be identified and described by Columbia, and then processed by George Blood Audio, then ingested by Columbia. George Blood Audio Video Film was previously called Safe Sound Archives. That's why it says that up there. And this diagram basically illustrated how this was going to happen, all the work that Columbia would be doing, and how they'd be giving us the information, what we'd be giving back. This presentation is focused on this section of the diagram. So this is specifically what Columbia is providing George Blood Audio, and then what we are doing with it, and how we're giving it back to them. Specifically, we're talking about objects, deliverables, and metadata. So digitized collections are great, right? They're good. But metadata makes them awesome. So let's take a minute and talk about getting on the same page about metadata. So some people refer to metadata as data about data. And this is true, but I urge you to think about metadata as data for doing things with your data. Metadata is the support system that allows you to do what you want with what you have. So for example, a file name allows a person or a computer to identify a file. And a file extension allows a computer to know what it's going to use to play that file. And if more technically minded people may also recognize that as well. And you might not think of those things as metadata, but they are. And then something you'll be more familiar with probably in this context is a checksum. And checksums allow us to make sure that we're not experiencing corruption across our files if they're sitting in a repository. And these are all kind of lower level metadata ideas, but things can get far more complex, and these complex structures will allow your files to be migrated, published, and cataloged, all using automated systems if they're properly structured. And all of these ideas are crucial in the realm of digital preservation. So you want good metadata, and you want it to be structured well. However, you really need to know what you want to happen before you can request the metadata that you need to make that happen. So you want to know what you want, and then you also want to make sure that your IT systems can support that. So what does it look like? Metadata can exist in many different forms and instantiations, and one of these forms is embedded metadata. This is metadata that's held within the header of your file, and it travels with the file and helps describe it. If you press get info on an MP3 in iTunes, you'll get this window. You may be familiar with it. This has a nice breakdown of some technical metadata, MPEG audio file, the size, the bit rate. And it's also got the descriptive metadata at the top. You just kind of describing, you know, giving you some description of it. And if you tab over to the next tab on the top, it gives you a bunch of fields of descriptive metadata that, that you can play with and fill in yourself. So this type of metadata is nice because it travels with the file, though it is a bit unstable. A lot of audio software doesn't play nice with this sort of metadata, and some of it can, some of them can blow away metadata that you've put into the file. In fact, a report published by the technical committee of ARSC in 2011 found that 7 of the 8 programs that they had selected, their commonly used audio programs, would not display some of the BEX chunk upon importing the files, and that 3 of them wouldn't display any. So be careful with what you do with your files once you have the metadata in them. And in that regard, you could also put metadata in spreadsheets or databases. So in this example, each row represents an audio object, and then each column is a metadata field describing those objects. And this type of organization is good for object-by-object descriptions, but it doesn't easily represent hierarchical data and relationships, which we run into a lot of in AV preservation, especially when you have layered folder nests and structures and derivatives. So that's where XML comes in. And XML stands for Extensible Markup Language. It's a markup language meant to be both human-readable and machine-readable, designed for representing and transmitting data structures. Because it works with nested elements and attributes, it can easily describe complex relationships, like the kind that pop up in AV preservation, which is why it's used with a number of audio and video metadata standards, such as AES X098B, 57, and PBCore. So, for example, what we do is we'll create a preservation master file from an AV object and put it in one folder and then nest in separate folders the different derivatives that are coming from that preservation master file. And if you were trying to put this in a spreadsheet, things would get messy pretty fast. So that's why XML is used. So, we've got like the what here. So I want to give you the objects themselves, So we're dealing with audio objects that contain oral histories, and these objects are often on open reel tapes, audio cassette tapes, or mini discs. And oral histories are an interesting beast, and because of some of the idiosyncrasies that we see with oral histories, the way they're organized on the physical objects, Columbia has decided to process the original objects into audio files using two modalities, and we refer to them as simple and rendered. So I'm going to try to describe to you what these processing modalities are. An object is processed as simple if there's no overlap of intellectual units across a single physical object. So that may mean that there's a single program on a single tape or a single interview spanning 5 cassette tapes, as long as there's not different intellectual content on a single physical object. It's processed as simple. So in the case of Columbia's oral histories, an intellectual unit refers to an interview session, and within the simple paradigm, each physical audio object holds no more than a single interview session. However, an interview may span across multiple tapes. Additionally, depending on the layout of the physical objects, there may be more than one set of digital objects per tape. So if you have an audio cassette tape that has 2 faces, you get a preservation master file from each face. And then now you have 2 digital audio objects that come from a single physical object. And the METS is used to describe the relationship between the mini audio files and any derivatives created from that audio file and the original of the original audio object. So with this picture here, it's just, you got one tape with 2 sides, and then we make a master file from each side, and then we can make any number of derivatives from that master file. And then it becomes, a little bit, it can be expanded to multiple tapes. So in this case, we have then a second tape. And so that file that comes from that side of that second tape would then be described separately initially from the other tape. So we create a master METS file to describe a single object. So the master METS file for the first tape would be describing both of these master files coming from it, and the second would only be describing the one. So then moving on to rendered, this is where things really start to explode. An object is processed as rendered if a single audio object contains more than one intellectual unit. So that would be maybe a single tape with two interview sessions on it. However, what we typically run into is we've got a big set of tapes, five tapes, where one person has been interviewed across these five tapes. However, there's two recording sessions or three interview sessions that span across the tapes, and some of the tapes contain information from multiple interview sessions. As just a little aside, this is a map that was made out of interviews being contained in a number of tapes, and in this case, each box represents a tape, and then the name represents the interviewee, and then the number represents the order in which the interview is occurring. And this is actually just a quarter of this map that I just took out so you could see it big on the screen, but there's just tons and tons of tapes. It's like ridiculous. And this is all mostly because when people are conducting oral history interviews, they're trying to save space and save money by trying to fill all the actual cassettes with as much information as possible. So instead of buying another tape and starting the interview session fresh on a new tape, they just start recording where they left off. And downstream, that has a huge effect because we need to be able to represent that, even though we're now moving the information from these physical objects to these digital objects that can be more malleable, but we want to maintain that original relationship. So in this case, we've got three cassette tapes with two interview sessions across the three of them. The first cassette tape just has the first session. The first half of the second cassette tape has the first session, and then the second half of the second tape has both sessions on it. Then the third tape has the second session. And as you can see, we create a master file initially from each side. Then we create rendered files. And these rendered files, we call them rendered files, but Sound Directions calls them production master files. It's basically all of the intellectual content is being cut up and then put into a single file per intellectual unit. So then from those rendered files, we can create any number of derivatives. And all of the information about which master files the rendered files came from is held in an ADL file per deliverable set, which contains AES 313 metadata. And I can show you what the ADL file looks like. This is all kind of information about which file, which portions of the sessions are coming from. And so now, with all that context, we can actually move on to the METS. And this is what it looks like. It's pretty exciting, isn't it? If you can kind of read that stuff. So METS overall has these sections in it. We've got a header, a descriptive metadata section, an administrative metadata section, a file section, a structure map, a structure link, and a behavior section. However, we don't actually need to have all of that. METS is extremely flexible, and it's what allows it to be used across multiple institutions and projects. So Columbia has kind of picked what they want. So they've got the header, descriptive metadata, administrative metadata, the file section, and the structure map. And we have these, the simple and the rendered projects, and they receive, both of them receive these top-level METS files and master METS files, and then the rendered projects also receive a rendered METS file. And I'm going to go describe this a little further. So starting with the top-level METS, that's sort of what describes this entire deliverable set. We start with the header, which contains information about the agents. That's George Blood Audio, Video, Film, and Columbia University Libraries. And then we've got the descriptive metadata section, which has the Dublin Core descriptive metadata. I don't know if this is readable, if there's anybody having trouble reading this, but it's the Dublin Core descriptive metadata is provided by the Columbia University Libraries to George Blood, and we're putting it in there. So that's just kind of goes from them, and we are stuffing it into the METS for them. You could actually use any other descriptive metadata standard that you wanted. Could use MARC or AES 60 if you wanted to, but Columbia has chosen to use Dublin Core because that's what they've got. So moving on from there, you've got the structure map, and this structure map for the top level METS file basically points to all of the other METS files in the deliverable set so that the repository knows where to find the information about this deliverable set. And then you've got the master METS file, which again has the same header, and typically it'll have the same descriptive metadata, but that descriptive metadata is per tape, not per deliverable set. So the description will say, you know, it's this tape number rather than just this interview. Then we've got the administrative metadata section, which contains technical metadata and source metadata. So the technical metadata here is represented as the Jove output, and Jove is an application created by Harvard for doing digital audio preservation and extracts metadata from audio files and can put them out in different formats. So there's an XML output that just dumps all the technical metadata about a file. So they wanted to receive that dump output, and then they also wanted to receive AES-XO98B technical metadata about each file. And so we use Jove and a libsound file to harvest that metadata and then format it into XO98B. So we're asking the file what it is. And typically in this closed environment where we're creating these files, we would know what this is, but we're still asking the file what it is and validating it. And then there's the source metadata section, which is the information about the original audio object. Again, that's mostly provided to us by Columbia. We have the format, and this is the information like the format type, the dimensions of the original audio object, the duration, and also any sort of intervention transfer notes, technical notes, cataloging notes about the original object are all stuffed in there. Then we've got the file section, which is a list of all the master files related to this master METS file. So if you have a tape that has two audio files that came off of it, there would be one master METS file for the tape, and then the file section would list file paths of those files and their checksums as well. And then you've got the structure map that actually maps the files listed in the file sec to the tape faces. Simple, right? It's really simple. So then we've got rendered. So the rendered has this extra deliverable, this extra option for a rendered METS file. So the top level METS is slightly different because there's an administrative metadata section with a source metadata of the ADL file. So it just kind of points to the ADL file and lets the repository know that where it's going to find it. And then in the structure map, the ADL file is also mentioned and mapped out with paths. Then in the rendered, the master METS is the same. We're creating the same master file and the same master METS for these files as we are with simple. However, we take the extra step of creating the rendered files, and there's a single rendered METS file for all of the for the single deliverable set. So you get one rendered METS file per deliverable set. And that starts off looking the same as the master METS file, where you've got the header, the descriptive metadata section, and the administrative metadata section. Though that's slightly different because the source metadata points to the ADL file again. So with the master METS files, the source is the audio object. However, with the rendered files, the source is actually the ADL file. Then we've got a file section which lists the rendered files, and it lists the service files, which are basically optimized for editing. They're not the preservation files, they're the editing files. And that's listed because of just the, with that project, they'll always be receiving those, so the METS is listing them. It lists their file paths and their checksums. And then we've got the structure map, again, pointing the sessions, pointing the rendered files and their derivatives to the actual sessions. And so there's a structure of how these files are created in the METS. So let's take a little recap of the what before moving on. We've got physical audio objects, we've got digital deliverables, and metadata to describe how these are related to one another. The structure of these XML files is complex, as is the process that brought the tapes into existence in the first place. The complex relationships within these METS XML files are crucial to documenting how the content came to exist within the digital realm without losing information about its original structure. And this is something that, as a community, we've decided is important. So it's important to understand how we are doing this mapping and making sure that we understand where these rendered files are coming from. So the question is it magic? It's actually not magic. We use a system of software, tools, management methods to make sure that this runs smoothly, and most importantly, that managing these projects doesn't become a project itself. So what happens first is Columbia collects the metadata and sends it to us in an Excel spreadsheet. And then Martha, our trusty registrar, will receive it and import it into our database. So this top section is sort of what, this is what it'll look like when we receive it. And then this is a little view in our database that has that same metadata imported into it. This is a little snapshot here. And this step is hugely important because it tells us how we're gonna process the objects. Columbia is just going to be sending these tapes our way. Maybe one or two at a time, and we have to know how to process them, whether it's simple or rendered. And when we receive these items, we're on our own to decide how to process them. And if you look at field K, you may be able to see it says one of two, two of two. That's a dead giveaway that it's going to be rendered, because that's referring to the session number of the tape. And so we've got, if you have more than one session, you're automatically going to have to process it as rendered. There's other little details that will point out whether something is simple and rendered, and we make sure, after going back and forth with controlled vocabularies and rules of entry for this spreadsheet, that Columbia will be giving us that information consistently across objects so that there's no confusion as to whether or not we need to be processing an object as simple and rendered. And it's this sort of transparency and making sure that we're both on the same page about how an object is going to be processed and how we're going to be representing that object in the metadata so that it's clear whether it's simple or rendered. And it's sort of that connection which keeps us from being 6 phone calls and 3 emails and just a single spreadsheet being sent along with tapes. So that's, once it's there and once it's in the database, Tad can do the transferring. If it's sticky or moldy or dirty, he'll take care of that right away. And, you know, we deal with tapes in varying states of deterioration every day and have very specific methods for dealing with all these types of damage. So once Tad has it all ready to go, he'll put it on the machine and make a broadcast wave preservation master file of each face. All the derivative files are created from this preservation master file, and Columbia receives broadcast wave service files as well, which are optimized for high quality production and editing, and sometimes receive MP3 web ready files, which are optimized for web publishing and broadcast. All these derivatives are created through automation, and an important aspect of this automation is that we verify what the original preservation master file is before moving on. So we want to make sure that the specs match. Is this 96K 24-bit? Sometimes it's not. If we're transferring born digital files, then they may be 44.1, 44.16, and then in that case, we have written into our automation with this format, which is born digital and has 44.1, ignore this catch, make sure it's 44.1, and then move on. So we have all these catches built into the system so that problems don't move downstream. And that's sort of what has kept this running, is making sure that we're catching everything, whether it's bad metadata at the onset or a bad file before transcoding. We need to catch these problems upstream so that they don't move downstream and then show up in the METS as issues. So once we've got all the files, the digital audio files ready to go, we can actually start creating the METS. The METS creation is all controlled by an Apple script, and that which starts by essentially the engineer opens up the window representing the deliverable set and hits go. And when they hit go, the Apple script first starts creating the master METS files. That's the first thing the script does. It goes to FileMaker to get the information about the header and the descriptive metadata section. It doesn't need the files for that, so it just goes straight to FileMaker, gets that information, and turns it into text for the METS. Then it goes to FileMaker to get the paths for the files. FileMaker knows where the files should be, and it uses that path, goes to Jove, and validates the files. We get all the information about the Jove dump and the XO98B and put it into the METS. Then FileMaker also has the source metadata, the metadata about the original object, and puts that into the METS. Then, when building the file section that contains the file paths and the checksums and the structure map, it goes to Finder and makes sure that those files are where they're supposed to be and validates the checksums, then puts those into the METS. So then we move on to making the rendered files. The script will then look and see, do rendered files exist? If they exist, it's basically the same process. We've got the core metadata and the agents from FileMaker, then to harvest the technical metadata. The main difference here is that it goes to Finder for the metadata on the ADL file and verifies that the ADL file exists before adding that in. Once we have all of the master METS and the rendered METS files, we can create the top-level METS, which runs the same way. The Apple script controls FileMaker to get the agents and the descriptive metadata, but then uses Finder to go through the folder and find the path for every XML file, whether it's master or rendered, and then puts those files into the file, lists the files in the file section, and maps them to one another. So that's how we do it. That's a nice description. And we're going to do a tech demo, and I've heard people say that tech demos are like thermonuclear war. The only way to win is to not play, but I'm going to do it anyway, so let's have fun. Where are we? Here we are. All right, so here is a transfer machine that I've remoted into. This here, it's going so fast. All right. This here is a record that represents a deliverable set. This in this layout, we have all the information about a deliverable set. So here are the different tapes, and then here are the different files that we've created from the tapes. And if you look here, we've got all the descriptive metadata that we've imported that Columbia has given us. So this is the file level representation of this. We've got this deliverable set here. My mouse. All right. So this is the folder that holds all the information. As you can see, we've got all the master files and their associated checksums, an ADL file, rendered files and their associated checksums, and then the service files created from the rendered files. And then we've got the Apple script that makes it all happen. No. No. All right. And here's the Apple script. So the engineer will have this record open. They'll open up this Apple script and hit run. And so it starts by creating the master METS files, and you'll see them start popping up. There it goes. It's a beaut. So it goes through, as you can see, each object had two master METS files created from it. So once it does that, it goes on to creating the rendered files, and it's just got to go through all of them. There's actually only two sessions here, so you would think there would only be two rendered files. However, because of the 2 gigabyte file limit imposed by broadcast WAV files, we have to split them into discrete chunks. So we have part one, part two, and that's an extra layer that will add to the confusion of this. So I'm just going to kind of gloss over it, and you can ask questions about it later. But we've got two sessions, and here's our rendered METS file. And once all the METS files are created, then we create the top-level METS file. And here it is right here. It actually worked. And here is what it looks like. This is a top-level METS file. I'll zoom in a bit. Let's see if I can do this. You've got the agents, George Blood Audio Video Film, Columbia University Libraries. Here's the Dublin Core descriptive metadata. And then this is the list. This is the file section for all the other METS files. So this is the first master METS, second, third, and then the rendered METS file. And we can open those up to take a quick look. The rendered METS file is fun. This one, I think, is 4,100 lines long. But it's all the information we need. So again, very top, you've got the agents and the descriptive metadata. As you can see, there's a section for each tape. And then if we scroll all the way through, this is all the really good stuff. I actually want to show you what the file, what the structure map looks like. So here's the list of files and their checksum, their paths and their checksums. And then here's the structure map that actually links the file IDs to the face IDs. So we have that sort of, this sort of representation of where these files are coming from and how they're related to one another. And that's it. That's what it looks like when it runs and when we have it. So back to here. There's one thing that I left out. I gave you the who, what, and how, but I didn't give you the why. And don't think that because I left it until the end of this presentation that you should leave it to the end of your project to decide on the why. This is the very first thing you should do. The reason I've left it out is because as a vendor, I can't give you that, and you've got to come up with that for yourself. There's a number of things that Metz is good for, but in the end, you'll have to decide what you want to get out of it. And when you do decide what you want to get out of it, make sure your vendor can provide it, and most importantly, make sure that your IT systems can support it. Thank you very much for listening to our amazing Metz.
And exactly on schedule, we have just enough time for a few questions before our lunch break. So if you have questions for Morgan, please raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone.
The way that you went about doing this project, was this, had you done this previously with a library or a collection? How much did Columbia bring to this? How much did you guys come up internally and suggest this to Columbia?
That's actually a better question for George, because I wasn't around at the onset of this project.
So Columbia was approached by Mellon to put together a model project which didn't break any new ground. So we have all these, we have Metz, we got Sound Directions, all these things going on. Let's pull them together and do a project with all of them. So over the course of a year and a half, Columbia used their AVDB survey tool and pulled materials out, and they were also building their Fedora repository. So over the course of a year and a half, we processed 1,200 tapes building this out on the fly. So there was this frequent back and forth with Columbia as, oh, we forgot something, or now that we got this case, we have to adopt for that. So the programming was about a one-half FTE for a year and a half as we processed about 1,000 items. And then in the 2.5 years since, there's this constant tweaking of the process. So there was the genesis of this project was Columbia was approached by Mellon. This is like, let's stop talking about and doing these reports. Let's execute a project and see what it looks like. And they aim pretty high.
So will you suggest this workflow to other people that come to you that maybe haven't planned this ahead of time?
We have two other projects that are looking at this kind of workflow. And having this base to work with is making a lot of that work much easier.
Yeah, actually, we just recently been working with the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and they have a bunch of video objects they want processed and represented like this. And so we were able to take the same outline and just replace the source and technical metadata sections with PBCore instantiations, actually. And it fit right in, and it was actually surprising how easily that came together once we had the overall structure already done, and we just had to basically create PBCore records for the physical objects and then the files, validate those, and then stuff them into the Metz, and it started working right away. Yeah, we also have University of Michigan also gets Metz, and it's got a lot of the same stuff in it. They have a lot of information about their digital provenance in there, which Columbia leaves out, and that's just another huge section that was developed, and there's a lot of overlap and a lot of the same tools. I mean, when you're at an institution and you're developing tools, maybe go through the folders and find all of the XML files so that you can map them properly. Once that's done, I mean, that can take hours to figure out, but then that information just passes along and becomes used in other projects.
One of the things we were very anal retentive about from the beginning is that all the technical metadata is harvested from the files. It's not like our database says, oh, they're all 9624, we'll just say. We actually ask the files to declare themselves. on all that basis. So there's an enormous amount of head scratching and code writing that goes into that, and that's the kind of infrastructure that we're able to build upon.
Other questions?
I was just sort of curious about, you mentioned directory structure and file paths a few times, and I know as files maybe are moved into a digital repository, that can sometimes be sort of lost, especially, you know, with the ADL file. Mm-hmm. It's giving you absolute file paths, telling you where to pull those files from to reconstruct maybe your deliverable. Is there any way that you're handling that or documenting it at more of a relative level, or I'm just kind of curious how that's looked at?
The way we process everything, as even going as deep as how we're shipping items, is from the deliverable set viewpoint. So when we put everything on a drive, we put it on the drive by deliverable set, and we create a manifest of that drive by deliverable set. We also include in the manifest the file manifest, so all the files that'll need to be there, but those are then kind of nested within each deliverable set, and that allows us to make a manifest that's comprehensive about what's on here, but also keep things as organized as possible within our paradigm. Now, once they leave us, what they're going to do with it is up to them. They're you know, imported into their system using this file nest because this was developed between us and them. So some institutions may receive our files and then re-nest them completely, but with something like this where we have this MET structure that's pointing to the files, they're going to keep that intact. However, because they have all that information, if they ever want to migrate to another file nesting system, they have everything they need there, and all they have to do is look at where those references are in the METs, do the migration, and then update the METs.
So all the materials, all the work internally is bound by an IP address and a long string of where it resides on our SAN. This was developed while they were building their Fedora, so that as they defined where they were going to put things, at the end of the day, you can just do a find and replace on this section of the file path. As a matter of fact, they do that on the fly rather than going in and doing that find and replace, because they'd have to regenerate and re-verify all of the files, because the XMLs also have a checksum that's verified.
Other questions?
Yeah, this process seems like it would be really useful for objects like multi-track recordings. Have you had any experience with that?
We have processed some multi-track recordings like this, and it's actually interesting because we can't use the automated system perfectly for this because it's expecting a certain input and then has a certain output. We ran into an issue where, because of a multi-track recording, we had too many faces because the script had written in that there shouldn't be more than four faces per object, because ideally that wouldn't happen, but then that actually caused problems because we couldn't process this object like that. So we have done that, and in that case we use the outline for what we know the METs to look like, and then actually have to do some hand encoding, and then we do verification of that. Okay. But yeah, it certainly could be used for that.
Is there one more question before lunch that I've missed? In that case, let's eat. Thanks to all our presenters.